Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Revolution Radio. We are very happy tonight to have a historic discussion with Commander Charles Kirshner and Attorney Mario Ahuzo about their recent filings in the Supreme Court. I'd like to start out by really wishing everyone a welcome. I especially hope that members of our military are listening, and any parents, sisters, brothers, sons or daughters of military members are listening this evening, because what we are talking about is really nothing short of a major constitutional crisis, having an ineligible commander-in-chief serving in that office. This issue cannot be underestimated, its seriousness, and as you noted on my blog today, that the usurpathon is going to continue to call attention to this case and why the Supreme Court needs to hear it. I'm just going to talk about a few things before our callers come on. Tonight we are basically going to go over the four questions presented before the Supreme Court, what a writ actually does, what it's attempting to do, and what the questions are and what the legal basis for all of those questions are. There were four presented to the court, and I will post the link again for you in this document. So I'm going to kind of lay out some of those questions for Attorney Apuzzo and Commander Kirshner, and then ask a few questions in there, particularly on the standing issue, because that is fundamental to our Constitution. Our Constitution and the Declaration of Independence protect our individual rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, due process, and so forth. It's not a broad area in which that occurs. So we'll be talking about all of those, some questions, and then we are going to open it up for questions, but we will be screening questions tonight because we really want issues to relate directly to this case. As you know, this is such a historic case. It's not really about comparison with other cases and so forth, or who's better and who isn't, or what's included or not. This is what we have. This is probably our best chance before the Supreme Court. And at this point, I'd like to, I believe, welcome Commander Kirshner and Attorney Apuzzo. Are you there?
Hello, Dr. Kate. This is me, Mario Apuzzo. Nice to be with you.
Good evening. Good evening. Commander Kirshner, is that you?
Yes, yes, I'm here. How's the audio level? Sometimes I have a little trouble here in my phone with the volume.
Okay, it sounds all right now, and I'm just going to put that out there in the chat room. If you have any trouble with audio, please let us know, but it sounds fine. I'd like to welcome you both, not only because you are my absolute favorite guest to have on, but because of the work you have done, I commend you. We had an introductory song here about people who love their country more than themselves, and I think you both are that example, and would like to thank you again for coming this evening.
Thank you for having us, Dr. Kate.
I agree.
Well, great.
Kiddos.
Great. Well, what we're going to start out with, I thought what we would do is, I have posted in the chat room the four, basically the four questions that you presented to the Supreme Court. And I'd sort of like to go through all of those, if you will, explaining that. But first, can you place for us, in the context of all the proceedings, which started at 2:50 a.m. on January 20th, 2009, where this writ is within the context of all the proceedings and what it means to write a writ? For example, just in my layman's place, the writ is really asking the Supreme Court and telling them why they should consider this case. It's not meant to re-argue every small detail. So let's start from there, either one, and then we'll go through the four questions.
All right, the first thing we have to understand that this, what I submitted is not a writ. It's a petition.
Excuse me. Sorry,
yeah.
Petition.
Well, you're not, yeah.
A petition for writ. Sorry.
Many people do that, and that's why I wanted to correct that now, so that way then we can start using the right language. It's a petition, and it asks for a writ. Okay, the writ basically is an order from the Supreme Court directed to the lower court, which is the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, ordering them to certify the record and bring it up to the Supreme Court. So that's what the writ of certiorari is telling the lower court, okay, certify the record and give it to me so that I can review it for error. And the petition asks that the court do that, okay? So I just wanted to make sure that's clear for everybody. And basically it starts out, you file a complaint in the federal district court. That's how you start the case. We did that January 20th, 2009, before President-elect Obama was sworn in. So he was still a private person, but more than a private person, because he had won the general election, the popular vote, and he also had won the electoral vote. So now the only thing that had to be done was for Congress to confirm him. They confirmed him. So now he is the president-elect, confirmed by Congress. There's really nothing left to be done in the political process. Just got to swear him in. And that's when, you know, we sued him at that point. And then just to add, we also sued him after he was sworn in. So now the executive powers have vested in him, so he has the powers to take action against my clients, the plaintiffs, one of which, of course, we have with us tonight, Commander Kirchner. Okay, so that starts that. Then that case gets dismissed by the district court on the motion to dismiss filed by the government saying that we didn't have standing. Okay, and at that point, they had two arguments, Article 3 standing, which is constitutional standing, and prudential standing, which is not found in the Constitution, but it's basically made by the courts. It's like a self-policing type standing. It's kind of hard to understand the difference between the two, but just let's, you know, for sake of argument, let's just continue so we don't get bogged down in that. And then they also argued political question. They argued immunity. They argued many different things. But the court granted on Article 3 standing, prudential standing, and political question. That was the district court. Then it went on appeal to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. Again, the arguments were basically standing, and these other. I argued that the court below had erred. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals said, no Article 3 standing. They didn't reach the question of prudential standing. They didn't reach the question of political question or nothing else, just Article 3 standing. They said no Article 3 standing, that therefore affirmed. And affirmed means I agree with the lower court, therefore the case is rightfully dismissed. Okay? Then from there, we have to petition the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, the petition is basically – you know, it's asking the court to accept the case. There's no right to accept it. It's not original jurisdiction. The Constitution provides for very limited circumstances where you can have original jurisdiction. Over the years, the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court has been cut back. You know, in many years ago, my God, they used to argue oral arguments for days. And, you know, the Supreme Court, they were basically reviewing every case that was filed there. And then over the years, Congress just kept cutting back and cutting back and cutting back the jurisdiction. So now you get very little review by the U.S. Supreme Court, very little. And so that's why you have to file a petition, which you're asking the court to review the case, as I explained earlier, you know, and you're asking for this writ. So that's where we are. And it's a very, very technical process, very limited. You got to write this petition in a certain way. It's got to be presented with the questions and then everything else that's in there that you've probably read, the petition. So now that brings us to the questions. And now, having said all that, let me give it back to you, Dr. Kay and Kate. I'm sorry, and then see where you want to go from there. Hello.
I'm still here.
Oh, what happened?
Dr. Kate?
Hang on. No, I'm here. Hang on. Sorry. It just takes – I have three computers in front of me, and it takes a while. So, yes, thank you very much for that explanation. And I just have to laugh because I practiced so much with Charles on petition versus writ, and, of course, I just blew it. But thank you for the lesson. All right. These are the questions you presented. They're unique, everyone. This is really sort of a culmination. If you've kept up with these filings, this is really where the meat is. So here's the first question. whether petitioners sufficiently articulated a case or controversy against respondents, which gives them Article III standing to make their Fifth Amendment due process and equal protection claims against them.
Yes, and what is your question about the question?
The issue is...
I guess she wants you to elaborate on it, Mario.
Yeah,
okay.
Just basically, tell us what you argued there, why you came up with that question in particular, because, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you didn't ask about this or ask about that.
Maybe I can throw in Dr. Kate. When I learned this too, you know, when this petition goes to the Supreme Court, they don't want all the detail. They want you to give them two or four questions that boil down why they should issue the writ of certiorari to take the case up. So Mario had he was literally up to 3 a.m. trying to boil this down into 4 questions. At the Supreme Court level, it's completely different than at the lower court. So they want bullets right up front,
yes,
the first page, 4 questions, and then they give them 30 pages to expand on it. But that's what these questions are. They have to be, interesting enough that they will take the case. Is that going to sum it up, Mario?
Yes. The questions have to be worded very, very carefully. No, they can't be argumentative. They can't be repetitive. For example, you can ask a question. If another question is fairly assumed or fairly included in that question, then that's it. You know, you don't ask the other question. Okay? So you have to really spend a lot of time on the questions, because you've got to be able to show what the case is about, because they really don't have much time to look at these petitions. They look at it very
quickly.
I'm sorry?
Has to compel them to take it.
Yeah,
you get about 18,000 a year, I heard, and you got to, like, in these questions, anywhere from 1 to 4, they don't like more than 4, according to what I read, you got to give them something to say that this is really, really important that requires the Supreme Court to take up this case, to bring it up with a writ of certiorari, that this question has to be answered.
Yeah,
what you said from the history is essentially all the courts have said, no, you don't have Article III standing and prudential standing, but basically Article III standing. So your first question here says, look, we do. Here's enough. Did we give you enough information to establish that standing? And I believe this basically gets down as well to individual liberty, what's guaranteed under the Constitution and protection. So go ahead from there.
Yeah, now there's a very carefully chosen word in that first question, the word sufficiently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because when you get down to standing, I mean, that's all you really have to do is just say enough of a case. Okay, you don't have to prove your case. That's not where, you know, you're having a trial and you're proving the case. You just have to have enough of a case articulated, which basically means that you've presented enough evidence, factual evidence, showing that you have this, first factor is injury in fact, okay? Injury in fact. So the word sufficiently is very important because, again, you know, that's a judgment call or it's really a tough one to get a hold of because, I mean, if you read these cases on standing, it's unbelievable what they turn on. I'll give you an example. The Lujan case, okay? Very, very famous case. I mean, that right now sets the standards for establishing Article III standing, where you have to show injury in fact, causation, and redressability. Okay, now, in that case...
Can I just say something, Mario?
Yes.
These rules that they judge standing on were created by the court. They are not in the Constitution.
Yes. The only thing that's in the Constitution, and that's why I picked that in my question, is case or controversy. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's in the Constitution.
Right.
But that's what the court uses. They use that in order to create the concept or the doctrine of standing. So the whole argument about standing kind of gets lost because you have to understand, you know, what does it connect to? Well, it connects to a case or controversy. Okay? So when the court says you have no standing, what they're saying is you have not presented a case or controversy. It's very important to understand that. Okay? So that's why I said articulated a case or controversy. You see? Because that's what the Constitution requires, and that's what standing is really about. It's about a case or
controversy. And in the first question, Mario specifically goes to the Fifth Amendment rights of due process and equal protection claims against them. And equal protection claims goes to protection of minority from the majority in the sense that the majority can just vote something and ignore the Constitution, and the minority has to live with it till the next election. Well, that's not equal protection under the Constitution. As in the case of McCain, getting the people listened to for McCain, and he gets investigated for his natural born citizen status. But Obama, with 10 times as many people bringing the protest to the Congress, and even lawsuits, he doesn't get investigated for lack of equal protection. So that first question there, you know, I think Mario sufficiently laid out the whole concept of standing and pointed out that the fifth, you know, have we showed sufficiently articulated case or controversy that they violated my Fifth Amendment's due process and equal protection claims? I think we have, but we're asking the Supreme Court now to see that show that the lower court maybe didn't recognize that we have shown sufficient and articulated a case of controversy. I think we have. The lower court says we haven't. So we're asking the question to the Supreme Court, if I can paraphrase what I've learned from Mario, we're asking them to say, hey, we think you have shown a sufficient and articulated a sufficient case.
Yeah, and just so it doesn't get lost here, because for some reason, I don't know why, you know, there must be some kind of magic in the sky or something, but it got lost in the district court. It got lost in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and now it's getting lost right now as we speak. But for some reason, there must be some magic to it. On the Fifth Amendment, okay, the whole concept of your life, liberty, safety, security, tranquility, and property, okay, those are rights that come out of the Fifth Amendment, the due process rights, unalienable rights that are spoken about in the Declaration of Independence. Okay, you know, given to us by our Creator. Mm-hmm. And now, that is connected to the Fifth Amendment. That's not connected to the equal protection argument. And those rights right there are the ones that are being injured by Obama and Congress. Okay? That argument was never addressed by either one of the lower courts. They just talked about... I'm sorry?
Sorry, please go ahead.
Yeah, they basically said that we complained about general grievances against the government, you know, general grievances. We didn't complain about general grievances. We complained about specific constitutional unalienable rights, okay, which I just you know, gave you a list of them. And,
yes,
and I explained how those rights are being violated by an individual who's supposed to be a natural-born citizen. You know, he's wielding this power. He's wielding the executive and the military power of the nation. And my clients, the plaintiffs, okay, have not consented to this individual being the president because he's not a natural born. And you know, wielding this power, he's injuring them. From the moment that he took office, he continues to injure them. He will continue to injure them while he's in office because, according to the founders, you cannot trust a person to be president who's not a natural-born citizen. You know, it's a safety issue, okay? The whole idea, if you study natural law, if you study the whole idea of keeping aliens out of your country, going back to time immemorial, it's a nation's sovereign right to keep out people who are not of your nation for safety purposes. For safety purposes, that gives a nation the right to keep somebody out who's not, you know, a citizen or who's, you know, inadmissible, whatever you want to call it. Okay, so it's all tied to safety, national security. The founding fathers gave it to us in the Constitution, in the Natural Born Citizen Clause, as it applies only to the president. Okay, which is a singular position, singular. Okay, so it all ties to protection. That's why
that's
we created the government. Yeah, that's why we
created the federal government to protect us, protect our inalienable rights, and in return for that, I will give them my allegiance.
Right.
Right, correct. Now, let me just add one other thing that I think is under fundamental assault here, and it has to do with the standing, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but basically our Constitution protects our individual rights, not just a mass. Not just
correct.
A group. It protects
individual
rights and
the minority,
so the standing.
Especially the minority.
Yes, and so the standing issue has been very much related to, hey, you know, you didn't suffer any more injury than all of Americans did. But our Constitution protects individuals. So I think that's also a fundamental of not only one of your strongest arguments is to link the need, you know, the Constitution's protection of our individual rights, but it's a very fundamental test for the Supreme Court.
Yes, exactly, and it's very important what you just said, Dr. Kate, because that's the reason why I suspect that neither the lower court, the district court, nor the Court of Appeals even mentioned or touched my argument about the Fifth Amendment. They passed it and called it general grievances. Okay, but I said, wait a minute. These are not general grievances. These are individual rights, just like you just said, individual rights. Okay, each one of us has an individual right to life, liberty, property. Okay, well, that's what's written in the Fifth Amendment. Now, out of liberty, you can put in there, of course, safety. I mean, how could you say safety is not in that? And security and tranquility. I mean, the Declaration of Independence even talks about tranquility. It's all part of that. Those are individual rights. Okay, it's not a general grievance. Okay, that's shared by everybody. You know, if my client has those individual rights, and if those individual rights are not being adequately protected, okay, by the government, then my clients have a right to go into court and ask for protection of those rights, which the government is supposed to protect, which they're not doing, because you got a natural, you know, you got somebody who's not a natural born citizen as the president, who you can't trust, according to the founding fathers, can't trust them, okay. So and that's very important what you just said, and that, again, that was totally avoided by both courts in our case, and I'm glad you focused on that.
I look at the founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, as the promise, and the Constitution is the fulfillment of that promise, the protection of our inalienable rights, which the founders fought and died for. I'm a direct descendant of a militiaman who served in the Revolutionary War, and they fought that bloody battle to gain their unalienable rights back after the British King was just ignoring them. And if you read the Declaration of Independence today and just put in the word Obama for King George and Congress for the Parliament, boy, it sure fits like hand in glove. And we have to, once again, apparently stand up and fight for unalienable rights because they're being usurped. And just because the political will temporarily of the majority wants to ignore the Constitution, we can't be told to go to the polls in 2 years. And meanwhile, the Constitution is null and void for 2 years. That's a ridiculous answer. That's one of the answers the courts gave us. We demand a protection promised in the Declaration of Independence and fulfilled in the Constitution. The Constitution is the fundamental law of this country, and we have to stay a nation of laws and not men, or this country will fall apart.
Yeah, and something else, too, I want to add to that is the concept of these unalienable rights. Okay, now, under the colonies, the rights came from the king, came from the crown. Okay, but the founding fathers, they recognized that these rights do not come from the king, and they do not come from the government. They come from They come from natural law and the creator, nature's God. Okay,
right.
That's where they come from. Now, when they talk about the Creator, I mean, you know, somebody might say, "Oh, that sounds religious," you know.
And Obama just left that out of the Declaration of Independence.
Yes, which is very, very dangerous, because you gotta always remember, and you gotta always keep it in the psyche and in the culture of your nation that those rights come from the Creator, not from the government. Okay, that's very, very important.
Right.
Now, when we talk about Creator, I'm not you know, preaching some religion or anything like that. The Creator could be anything that you know within your own soul, within your own conscience, you know, gives you these rights. Okay, if you believe in God, then they come from God. If you believe in nature,
a higher power than man himself.
Yeah, they come from nature. If you believe in
right.
the universe, whatever you believe in, that's where these rights come from. But the important point to understand is that they do not come from the government, because we the people, we created the government so that they can
exactly.
protect our rights. So we already had the rights.
Right.
We already had them. Nature gave us the rights, or our Creator, whatever you want to choose for that, depending on your faith. So that's very important to understand that, and that's what we're looking to have protection here.
And the revolutionaries fought a many-year war to prove that point. And once they won the freedom to use their God-given unalienable rights, they created a government to protect those rights, and they created the Constitution is there to a social contract that government is supposed to make sure that the people's unalienable rights are protected in perpetuity for generations to come. And there's a way to amend the Constitution, a legal way. They put that in there too. It isn't set in stone. But you just can't do it with a simple vote and say, I'm not going to follow this part of the Constitution anymore, and you 49% that lost the election, tough. That's not the
right.
way this system works.
And to tie it all together, which underscores to everyone out there the brilliance of just this first question, because it
yes.
pulls everything forward. The attack on our individual rights is protected by the Constitution.
Right.
The use of standing of judicial invention to basically, again, perpetuate an attack on our individual rights, or ignoring that for whoever's listening, and to eliminate our opportunity for the exercise of our Fifth Amendment rights and duties as we are entitled to. So all of
every word in that question, Mario, put in there for
correct.
A reason. There's not one word too many in that question, and not one word too little.
That's
every
correct.
Word every word in that question has meaning to it. And Mario could take those words one by one and tell you why they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not any extra ones. And there's not any extra ones.
That's correct. And I also want to highlight again what Mario said and what we all and Commander Kirshner have been talking about is the national security, the safety of our country, and how critical that is. And through the course of this historic research in this case, the things you unearthed and wrote about, Commander, on James Madison's first view of Article 2, Section 1,
right.
Clause 5, and how it was, in fact, changed. And perhaps you could just share that story as well before we move on to now the discussion of NBC.
Alexander Hamilton proposed in the first draft he prepared of the proposed Constitution that the eligibility clause as to citizenship would simply require a person be born a citizen, meaning a native born a citizen. When 4 to 5 weeks later, when John Jay learned of this, he was very much concerned about foreign influence after the revolutionaries were gone and somebody working their way back into the halls of the government with foreign influence on them, and taking back control and giving us back to the British, for example, or some other power. So he wrote a letter to John Jay wrote a letter to George Washington saying, we have to strengthen that clause. We need to put in, he said, let me hint, in other words, let me suggest, as a strong check to the person to the command of our military will devolve, that he shall be a natural-born citizen, not just born a citizen or a citizen by birth. A natural-born citizen, and that adjective natural goes to the parents, and it comes from Vattel and the Law of Nations, where a natural-born citizen, he used the Mattel used the word naturels, and that was translated in 1781 in the Articles of Confederation, even before the Constitution was written. The word naturels was translated in a treaty discussions to mean natural-born. So the naturels that Mattel wrote in French translates to the natural-born citizens. He defined what he meant by that word. Those are the children of the citizens' parents born in the country to citizen parents, plural. So that is what George Washington got from John Jay. We went to strengthen the eligibility clause on citizenship status that only a natural-born citizen can ever get in command of our military. George Washington got it. It was stuck in, and the rest is history. And anybody that tries to say a natural-born is the same as a native-born, as we understand it today, where you're born in the country. That particular debate and that particular first proposal of what the eligibility clause should read and what it was changed to and why, as a strong check against foreign influence, the only way you can have a person born with no foreign influence at birth, either from being the rules of birth, location, and who your parents are, is to have yourself born in the country of two citizen parents of that country, so that you have no other claim on you by international law from another country that your mother was a citizen of my country, so I claim you, or your father was a citizen of this country, so they claim you, or you're born outside the USA in another country, so they claim you. Unity of citizenship at birth, sole allegiance at birth is what they wanted for the commander of our military. That's what a natural-born citizen is. Mario wrote a superb essay on that called Unity of Citizenship. It was published in the Washington Times. And that's what happened. They actually changed it from being born a citizen as being acceptable to a natural-born citizen. Now, if there was no difference, why did they change it?
Correct.
John Jay's letter explained why they changed it too, because there is a difference.
Yeah, if I can add to that, the founders, the framers, they were so clever when they wrote things. They knew that Congress was also clever. They knew that too. They knew that they had the power to naturalize. So what Congress does, they can pass a law that says that you are a born citizen. They can actually do that.
Naturalize back to birth.
Yeah, they can say, well, you're a born citizen now, okay? In other words, you could be born anywhere or in any kind of situation, and they could declare you to be a born citizen, and which is what the British did. You were a naturalized citizen, and they called you a natural born subject, and you were naturalized. Okay?
And we have a statutory law, Title 8, Section 1401, that handles that. If you're born overseas to two U.S. citizens, you're born a citizen.
Yeah, so the founders, they recognized that, and they said, wait a minute. And that's why, like Hamilton, he just said, born a citizen. The founders realized that you could mess around with that. You could play with that, and you can create born citizens. So they
right.
said natural born. Natural
and only,
born.
Only nature can create natural born citizens. No
yeah,
law.
Right. There's no law that can do it. You can't acquire it somehow. You can't create it with a law, with a statute, whatever. And again, then the question is, well, what's natural born? Because when you're born, there's two things that happen, not just one. You're born in a place, and you're also born to someone. Those are the natural elements of birth.
Now,
and,
before we Just hang on one second, because that's going to lead us right into your second question, which I posted, which is basically whether Obama can be an Article II natural-born citizen if he was born in the United States to a U.S. mother and a non-U.S. citizen, British father, under the British National
Act. You're reading the question
Act.
Now, right? Question number two,
I am.
Right? Okay.
1948. But basically, your second question goes to that, but I just wanted to, like, sort of collect what we have here. So
I interrupted you, Dr. K. Could you read it again so it's clear to everybody? I didn't know you started the second question and I interrupted you.
Oh, well, let me, before I did that, because I interrupted myself, I think, and interrupted Mario, because we are getting to the question of what a natural-born citizen is, and I wanted to note for our audience, and just maybe just plain as day, but up to this point, the argument against this case from Obama has just been about standing. They've done nothing. They've put forth no alternative explanation. No reasoning, no documentation, no nothing. They've hoped like heck this has gone away. I've called it a straw man's case. And so
it's worse than that, Dr. Kate, because the lower court assumes that all the merits and facts are true. Correct,
that's
Mario?
That's correct.
Yes, Jack, which, you know, they only say that, but they really are not applying it. Because, you know, if they have to assume that Obama is not a natural-born citizen and that he hasn't proven that he was born in America, or, you know, in Hawaii. I mean, that's a big deal right there.
Right.
Because you have to assume that if you're going to do a motion to dismiss our case.
Now, again, just let me just make a couple of announcements. Folks, we've got folks on the phone with their hands raised. I just want to let you know that we're going to allow this to go all the way through the four questions. So I don't anticipate taking any questions till for about another half hour or so. So if you hang on, that'll be fine. So anyway, just from that standpoint, yes. So let's move into the second question, which is about not only what a natural-born citizen is, but everyone listen to this very carefully. And pardon me for interrupting the flow, but I think we keep it going this way. Here's the question. Whether putative, remember, it's never called president, putative President Obama can be an Article II, quote, natural-born citizen if he was born in the United States to a United States citizen mother and a non-United States citizen British father and under the British Nationality Act of 1948, he was born a British citizen. That lays out hundreds of pages of work and so forth. So let's move on from there, Mario, again with our same discussion. This is the meat of natural born citizens. And here you've invoked a number of other citizenship acts, the British Nationality Act and so forth. So we all want to hear again how you got to that point. Other people argue, you know, oh, that's natural-born citizen means only born in the USA. So both of you, please, just take it on from there. The second question is, can he be a natural-born citizen? Again, note the wording. Please go from there.
Okay. And boiling down hundreds and hundreds of pages of briefings into one question. Boy, what a masterpiece Mario did here.
Correct. Congratulations.
Yeah, you're right about hundreds and hundreds of pages. You have to think really hard how to say something like this. So I guess both of you appreciate having to come up with a question like that. But here's first of all, this is just as an aside. When I said British Nationality Act 1948, I didn't forget to say of. That's how the British cite their law. They don't say of 1948. Okay, just British Nationality Act 1948. I just wanted to clear that up for everybody. It wasn't that I forgot to put of in there. Okay, now, this says if he was born in the United States. Okay, so now that leaves open the remember earlier when we talked about the questions? If you have a question and another question is subsumed within that or is like, you know, implied within it, you're good to go. You don't have to keep saying all the other questions. So that question right there fairly raises the question if he was born in the United States, okay? So you've covered the other issue about the birth certificate, okay? Now, I don't know whether, Dr. Kate, whether you realize that in reading that question, but it's in there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, so assuming that, now let's assume that he was born here. Let's assume that, and let's assume that he was born to a citizen mother and a non-United States citizen father, and also because of the British National Act of 1948, he was born a British citizen. You know, assuming those facts to be true, can he be a natural-born citizen? Now, of course, you have to have a definition of a natural-born citizen in order to answer that question. So it raises the question also of what is a natural-born citizen. You see, so that question raises many, many other questions. it raises the question, well, wait a minute, how is he a British citizen under the Nationality Act? How is he, was his mother a citizen? Well, yes. Well, how's his father not a U.S. citizen? Then you explain that part, okay? So there's all kinds of different, elements to that. But assuming that you put the whole thing together.
Well, let me throw in at this point, Mario, real quick, is that if they take the case, Mario gets a chance to brief all these questions.
Well, not necessarily true.
No?
Completely.
Okay.
No, let me explain why. Because the Supreme Court, if they accept the case, they will tell us what questions they want to deal with.
All right.
You see? So
okay.
I've argued in the petition that, given the nature and the importance of the underlying merits, okay, that they should also reach the merits, notwithstanding the fact that neither of the lower courts reached the merits. You see? So
right.
That question there, number two, goes to the merits of the case.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not about standing. That's about
right.
The merits. Okay? Now, again, the merits, we all know that no court, except maybe one court, okay, which was not a federal court, the Indiana court, they reached the question of what is a natural-born citizen. And, again, I don't want to even talk about that.
But they didn't even – they just stated it. They didn't even do any investigation. In fact, they said that – they called Vattel, who was the most preeminent scholar on the law of nations of his era for 100 years. They called him some unknown Swiss philosopher.
Unbelievable! Unbelievable! Right.
And if amicus curia brief of a case argued yesterday at the Supreme Court, they in that brief said that Vattel was the most preeminent scholar on the law of nations of his time. Right in there in front of the Supreme Court yesterday, they mentioned Vattel. And this case in Indiana, what was the name? Anke case?
Anke.
The state judge says, oh, some unknown Swiss philosopher, I'm supposed to believe what he wrote?
Right. It is shocking, absolutely shocking.
Shocking.
And the case that Charlie's talking about is Ruben Flores Villar versus United States of America.
That was the one from yesterday.
Yeah. Not only is that brief tells about Vattel, but there's oh my God, there's so many writings, law reviews and case law, commentaries. I mean, it's just endless, the amount of information that is buried and that has been forgotten, okay, that tells us who Vattel is, okay?
Right.
There's like a mountain of information, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then again,
but that case could be helping us in educating the court on Vattel.
This Ruben Flores Villar?
Yeah.
Yes. But,
and the press and the lawyers of this country who have conveniently wanted to forget Vattel could be reminded by that case.
Yes, absolutely. The
progressives want to forget Vattel because he believed in a strong constitution, a written constitution.
Yeah, but anyway, so let's see, where were we? The second question. The question then is, what is a natural-born citizen? And, we've already touched upon it, but let me just give some information. And I know Charlie, he's got a lot of information on that. But anyway, basically, Vattel says that a natural-born citizen is a child born in the country of citizen parents. That's what he says.
Mm-hmm.
Very very simple. And it also says that the natives or the natural-born. See, there's a lot of confusion about this word natives. A lot of confusion about that. In the beginning of our country, native and natural-born meant the same thing. Okay.
The word federalist. A federalist back then was one for a strong federal government. A federalist today is one for state government rights. Opposite.
Yeah, words
change.
Yeah, they do change. But if you read section 212 says the natives, comma, or natural born citizens, comma, are those born in the country of parents who are citizens. So clearly,
he told us what those words mean. That's the point. Even though that was an English translation of the word of the first English translation done in 1759, they translated it to natives. when they retranslated it in 1797, they called a better translation. They put the words natural born citizen in there. But also in 1781, on the Articles of Confederation, translated the treaty as to the word naturels, which is what the word Battelle used in French, it was translated as natural born. So, you know, we're dealing with translations, but and choice of words in English compared to words in French, but Battelle clearly defined what he meant. He meant that citizens enjoy the rights and privileges of society, but the natural borns are the ones born in the country of citizen parents. So whether you want to call them X, Y, or Z, he told you what he meant.
Yes, he gave the definition, and there's no doubt that the founding fathers were looking at that particular definition. Even Justice John Marshall in 1814, he was one of the founders.
Right.
In the Venus case, when he started defining what citizenship was, he looked to Vattel. Now, what does that
tell
you?
He said Battelle is the best on this subject, I believe. Yes. Those were his words.
He was a founder, Justice
right.
John Marshall. He was of that generation. Why would he look to Battelle to define citizenship if it was the English common law that did it? It makes absolutely no sense, okay? I mean, there's tons of information on this, and this will all be briefed, you know, if the Supreme Court, of course, takes this case and asks for a briefing on the meaning of natural-born citizen. But The point is that, and Charlie said something very important. He said that Battelle told us what a citizen was, and he also told us what a natural-born citizen was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's very, very, very important, because if you look at Article 2, okay, it talks about citizens of the United States, and it talks about natural-born citizen. You see? So, and what's also very important is that you have to understand that the United States of America – has a unique experience because it's an infant state created from a revolution. So when that happens, when you replace one government with another, the first question that you have is, well, wait a minute. You know, we just started a new country. Who are the citizens? Okay, so that's why.
Well, there's another point there, though, Mario, is that there were actually 13 independent sovereign states after the Revolutionary War. There wasn't a solid United States of America yet. There was just an Article of Confederation of 13 independent sovereign states. They didn't look to the common law of any one state and the constitution of any one state to form the federal government. They didn't look to the common law of England, who they just threw off. They looked to universal law, natural law, and the law of nations to unify 13 independent states and create a federal government that would govern 13 independent and sovereign states. They didn't look to any particular country's law. They looked to the law of nations.
Right, which was based on natural law. But the point is, when they created the Constitution, they had to say, well, who's a citizen? Okay?
Right.
Now, we're talking about, you know, after the 13 colonies, now they're creating, you know, the United States of America. And they said, well, we have to have citizens to start with. Those were your members of society. That's why Battelle describes the citizens as members of society, okay? It's like an entry-level membership, you know? And if you read Pufendorf, okay, he'll tell you that when a society is created, those who were born into the society, those who were here, those who made that society, those are your citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Those are your citizens, and that's exactly what Battelle says.
They're the original citizens.
Yeah, and that's what the founders said in Article 2, that if you're a citizen now, you can be president, okay? Because you're an original citizen. You know, you're here during the Revolution. You know, you're an older person. You were born not in the United States. You were born in the colonies. Your parents were British, okay? But because you were born into this new government, and you adhere to it, you're a citizen. You're an entry-level member of that society. And that's what Battelle starts out with, okay? But then Battelle says, but the children of those citizens are your natural-born citizens,
that's
are your
right.
natives, you see?
The second generation of citizens in the
right,
country.
Right. And, of course, that's confirmed by
– And the purpose of that is that that those natural-borns are well-marinated in the culture and the society they are a member of. They're born into it, and their parents were citizens and were loyal to that country. So
yeah,
the natural-borns are marinated with two generations of the culture from their parents, and they lived it themselves. So that's the way you get the loyalty innate in that person to the belief in that society, that country, to be able to be the commander of our military, to somebody that we can trust is going to protect us and is not going to be influenced by a foreign national father who never swore allegiance to this country.
And Vattel says that it is only those children of the citizens who will perpetuate the society.
Exactly.
They will perpetuate it. So in other words, there's your preservation of the new United States of America. It's gonna be up to the children of those initial, because those initial citizens, you know, they still have that natural allegiance. They could be you know, homesick.
They bled to create the country.
Well, yeah, they proved their allegiance by bleeding for the country.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
You know, they overcame their natural allegiance. Okay, and therefore the founder says, well, look, you know, we can trust these individuals to be the president, because my God, who else you gonna have? Your children are not old enough. You got to start someplace. So you
got to
start with.
Logic tells you have to start with your first set of citizens.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right. So I wanna just like segue just a little bit in here for a second, because I wanna point out, of course, the tremendous PR to just consider Article 2, Section 5, Section 1, Clause 5, as meaning just, quote, born in the USA, and why the historic research and filings here have definitively proved
that. Well,
I
went over that. Hamilton
said
Hamilton proposed
that
simplicity, and they rejected it.
That's correct. And so this is what has to be seen and heard, and what will be heard, and when that is there, the only record that exists is the record that's been done here. There is no, for those of you who are listening to this and think, well, you know, Blackstone's got an argument, I want to say prove it. Where is it? You can't find Blackstone cited in the Declaration of Independence or the U.S. Constitution. So,
but you can find the Law of Nations. The concept of the Law of Nations is in there.
Correct.
Blackstone was important when it came to states questions.
Right.
Okay. The English common law, state, you know, contracts, property, inheritance,
mm-hmm.
torts. Mm-hmm. You know, he was the authority on English common law, which was used in the states for local
mm-hmm.
questions. Okay, that was Blackstone. But when it came to the federal government, when it came to natural law, the law of nations, the new
yep.
law that was going to
which governed the relationship between the states and the United States and the world.
Yeah, when it came to that law, it was not Blackstone; it was Vattel.
Right.
Okay, and there's plenty of authority on what I just said. Okay, so you look to Blackstone when you're dealing with English common law, states issues. You look to Vattel when it came to natural law and the law of nations, international. They didn't call it international law then.
Interstate relations, that's where the Constitution addresses interstate commerce, you know.
Exactly.
Yes,
now, let me point out a couple of other things before we get to your third point. We've got lots of folks on the phone, but I don't want to miss anything. Thank you for pointing out that you quote, if he was born in the United
mm-hmm.
States, because for those who are out there trying to divide these issues of whether one goes after the birth certificate or whether one goes after the whole concept of natural born citizen, you know, be relieved, please, because this lays that out as well. If he was born, what evidence is going to be necessary for that? So there it is.
Every word Mario chose is in there for a reason.
Right.
Every single word. Not one too many
right.
and not one too less.
And so for in here, it brings out exactly all the relevant points, of which the birth certificate is a small piece. And so, yes, I agree with you and, again, congratulate you. I think there is a question about the British Nationality Act, if you could just explain a little bit more of that. Can a person lose their citizenship, lose British citizenship, once you are born with it?
Well, I tell you, there's, under the English common law, you cannot lose your British citizenship. Okay, if you're born with it, that was called natural allegiance. you couldn't lose it. You know, you, it's not like in the United States we adopted the notion of being able to throw off your natural allegiance. Okay, and Jefferson, in his citizenship laws in Virginia, he was very careful to put that in there, that once you become a citizen, if you want later on to throw it off, you can do it. Now, Battelle, he wrote that very clearly. It's a person's right to throw off their allegiance and to join another society, especially if the society is not providing for their happiness. Okay? You know, there's no reason why an individual should stay in a society and not be able to go into another one. Now, of course, we have, you know, immigration laws and that sort of thing. We just can't be, you know, jumping countries like, although, you know, if you look at what's happening to the United States, I don't know about that. I mean, people, you know, all over the place here, they just come over here. But you know what I'm saying.
Another thing, Mario, they have to judge this, whether Obama's situation in 1961 when he was born. They shouldn't be reading today's laws and then apply them back to 1961 and forget that Obama was born under the British Nationality Act of 1948, as amended.
That's correct. That's correct. Now the complication, and I know why you're asking that question, Dr. Kate, mm-hmm. because we know that in 1963, Kenya got its independence, and the law was changed as to citizenship. British citizens, they were called kooks. Citizenship of the United Kingdom and colonies, you know, they were told by the new law, the independence.
Did you just call Obama a kook?
Yes.
Sorry about that, Mario.
No, let that one pass. I always think the same thing when I say that kook. But anyway, 1963, that was the Independence Act of 1963 that said, okay, if you're a kook, now you're a Kenyan citizen. And they had some exceptions to that, okay? But, you know, those exceptions don't apply in our situation. So then basically Obama's father and also Obama, when Obama was 2 years old, he became a Kenyan citizen. Because of that. Now, the question is, okay, well, he became a Kenyan citizen. Is he still a British citizen? Okay, now, we know that in the United States, the Constitution says, hey, if you're born here, you know, Congress doesn't have the power to take that away from you if you're born here. They can't pass a law and say, oh, you're no, you know. But if you're born out of the United States, Congress has all kinds of power. They can make you a citizen. They can take it away. There was a period in our history from 1806 to 1852, around that. Don't quote me exactly, but during that time period, where people were born out of the country to U.S. citizens, and they were not citizens. They were not citizens, okay? And then Congress fixed that. Because, you know, early, like 1790, the first Congress said, oh, if you're born outside of the United States of citizen parents, you're a natural born citizen. Here's the key on that. There's a lot of confusion on that. They said considered as a natural born citizen. See, considered
they say,
as
they didn't say you were one. They didn't
right.
say you were one.
Yeah, considered as is like saying deemed. Okay, that's what it means. So again, Congress is using its naturalization powers to do that. So you're naturalized.
But they repealed that then, Mario.
Yeah, they repealed it in 1795, and then Congress has never touched that natural-born citizen again. And rightfully so, because Congress, it wouldn't make sense.
It takes nature to make one, not Congress.
Yes. It takes nature. And, again, going back to, natural born.
Now, that's where we get into moving ahead to the freeing of the slaves. Since their parents were never citizens, they had to pass the 14th Amendment to make the slaves that were freed citizens so that their children would be citizens, children of citizens, and then be natural borns. They had to start the clock working with the slaves that were freed by the 14th Amendment, making them born citizens.
Yes. And that was a historical accident. That's what I'll call it. Because when the new nation started, you know, there was some slaves here. Okay? And now, under natural law, you know, there's no reason why anybody can't be a citizen under natural law, because everybody's equal under natural law. But
exactly.
because of politics, let's call it politics,
right.
Okay, or policy, whatever you want to call it, you know, we
the
had
evil,
slaves.
The evils of man.
Yeah, we had slaves. So that complicated the question of who you know, could they be a citizen because they're born into slavery. Okay, but then of course that was done away with the Civil Rights Act of 1866, and
mm-hmm.
then of course the 14th Amendment in 1868, where it said, look,
and that
you're
made
born-
them that made them citizens, not natural born citizens.
Yes,
they were
yes.
made citizens, and then their children could be natural born citizens.
Yes, yes. So now getting back to Dr. Kate's question about whether. You know, if you're born a citizen under the 1948 Act, you know, a British citizen, what happens, okay? You know, that's a very complicated question, very complicated, because, you know, if Great Britain said, well, now you're a Kenyan citizen, okay, does that mean that you're no longer a British citizen? Well, first of all, it's not really relevant on the question of Obama. And the reason why it's not relevant is because you have to be a natural born citizen, okay? So it's your state of citizenship as of when you're born. It doesn't matter what happens later on. Just like a naturalized citizen, right? If you're born in a different country, and let's say you naturalize when you're like 6 months old, 6 months old, or even, you know, 2 months old, you naturalize. You cannot be president, even though
right.
now for your whole life you're an American citizen.
If you're born a dual citizen, meaning you have allegiance through the parent, the soil, or the other parent, you can't be a natural-born citizen. It doesn't matter what the laws of the other country says.
Yeah. So the thing is, it's as of when you're born. So
right.
it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Like some people say, oh, well, you know, he lost his British citizenship because he became Kenyan. And then
or if he went
was,
out tomorrow and renounced his British citizenship, I renounce all allegiance to foreign potentates, the King of England and Queen or whatever, that's still he can lose his British citizenship claim, but he is still not a natural born.
Exactly.
Of the United States.
Just like a naturalized citizen. You're a naturalized
right.
citizen, you were born subject to a foreign power. Okay? Now, the law, okay, going back to what I was saying about born citizen. The law naturalizes you. So, in other words, it brings you back. In other words, it makes you like you were born an American citizen. It naturalized. Think about that. It naturalized you. In other words, it made you a born citizen, okay, by naturalizing you. But you're not a natural born citizen. You're a born citizen through naturalization, through a law. You're not a natural born citizen. So, that's, again, it doesn't matter what happens later on. If he lost
a natural-born citizen, doesn't need any law to move you back in time.
Right. There's no law because the reason why, because you're not. It's a natural event. You're born of the soil and
right.
of those parents, and those elements right there are what a natural-born citizen
right.
is.
At 1 second before your birth, in the womb, you are on the soil of a country. Your father was a citizen, your mother was a citizen. That's the laws of nature.
Right, right. So it's very important to understand that. It doesn't matter if Obama lost his British citizenship, he became a Kenyan citizenship, then he let it expire at age it's 23, not 21, because the law in Kenya gave you two extra years at 23. But it's important to understand that he was born with British citizenship, then he had Kenyan citizenship all the way until he's 23. Those are formative years. Those are formative years. And then, again, under the British common law, you know, he didn't lose his British citizenship. He did not, because once you're born a Brit, always a Brit. You know, we know that. We've heard that through history. So I hope that I've given some insight into that, Dr. Kate.
Yes. Yes, and I want to point out a couple of things. I mean, as a natural-born Brit, and so, you know, that bumper sticker, born a Brit, not legit, is a good one. And
yes,
it's a good way to start. Also, to point out the use and identification of dual citizen. And again, for those who think that this case is not going to result in the production of papers, you can't tell if this guy was born anywhere or naturalized or if he renounced any British citizenship or was naturalized here because he hasn't released his papers. So ergo, this case must go forward, and when it does, this information is going to have to be released. So in thinking about our time here, let's move on to the third question, which I will post. But basically, this question asks about whether Obama or Congress and Congress violated the Fifth Amendment due process rights to life, liberty, safety, security, tranquility, and property, and also the Ninth Amendment rights by Congress failing to follow the 20th Amendment. I'm not going to read the whole thing, I'll post it, but this is now bringing in Congress and Obama on the Fifth Amendment due process rights. So,
and that's the key point. This is the only lawsuit they get up here that sued Congress for its failures.
Correct. That's correct. So in this regard, I've heard some comments of people saying, no, this is just a ministerial duty and we could never sue Congress and we could never compel them to do their job. I think you disagree with that. Tell us how you have weaved this Fifth and Ninth Amendment. Most of us who are listening are educated, so we've read your stuff. So if you could just quickly, you know, or give us your thoughts on every word that comprised paragraph question number three.
Well, first of all, it's, yeah, you could say it's ministerial, but you know, the Congress has to make sure that he's a natural born citizen, or else what is the
Correct.
Purpose of the 20th Amendment? What is the
right.
purpose
Correct.
Of confirming the electoral votes? Now, the 20th Amendment says, or if the president-elect shall have failed to qualify, you see? Now, qualify. Who qualifies? Somebody's got to qualify. Somebody's got to do it. Congress is the gatekeeper at that point because the popular vote you cannot trust, and the founding fathers did not trust the popular vote. That's why they created the Electoral College.
That's why they created a republic and not a pure democracy.
Yeah, you know the popular vote. People can get crazy. They could be voting out of vengeance or out of fear or whatever. Party spirit. I mean, you got all kinds of reasons why people are voting.
Sell their vote for a shot of whiskey in a tavern.
Yeah. You got all kinds of situations going on. So then you have the Electoral College that's supposed to be a gatekeeper. Okay, they're a gatekeeper, but. They're still not the ultimate gatekeeper. The ultimate gatekeeper is
But the political
Congress.
Parties have stacked state law to require the Electoral College now to vote for in 27 states to whatever the people vote. So they lost their power.
Right. So much for gatekeeping, right?
Right.
But then you get to Congress, and there's your final gatekeeper right there.
Right.
And if the president – so now you're done with the popular vote. You're done with the Electoral College vote, and you have a president-elect – and he could still fail to qualify. See that.
And what does the word "qualify" mean? There's only one thing in the Constitution that you got to qualify him for.
Right.
There's three different parts: natural born citizen, 35 years old, and lived in the country 14 years.
Exactly.
So simple, and that they didn't do it.
Yeah, and that's where if you want to call it a ministerial duty, I mean, okay, they got to look at the guy. Well, yeah, he's old enough. Yeah, he lived here, long enough. Now, what gets more complicated is, well, is he a natural-born citizen? Well, come on.
And it isn't like nobody asked. 500,000 people wrote petitions to Congress.
Yeah, and what is a natural-born citizen? As a minimum, you got to say, well, okay, was he born in America? Okay, unless you're going to get into some kind of an exception, but we don't want to get into that. But, what evidence did Congress have that Obama was born in Hawaii? What evidence? None.
A picture on the
none.
Internet. A picture on the internet.
Yeah, which is a Kolb. I mean, we've been down this road a million times, but that Kolb is not even accepted under Hawaiian law, itself, because if you're going to use a certified copy of the original birth certificate, that certified copy has to contain all the information, all the contents of the original birth certificate. The original birth certificate has the name of the hospital and has the name of the doctor. That
right.
Kolb does not even contain that. So under
right.
Hawaiian law itself, it is not valid as a birth certificate. So it's the biggest lie going in America that document is a valid birth certificate because it does not contain the same information that's contained in the 1961 contemporaneous birth certificate. You look
and then
at
you
Hawaiian
even
law,
get into the fact that that image on the Internet could be forgery.
It's that right. That's a whole different issue, too. But even if that COLB is legitimate, it is not sufficient to replace the original birth certificate because it does not contain the complete contents of the original birth certificate. And that complete contents is so important because we're talking about the hospital and the doctor, and that's what's missing here, you see? So anyway, so Congress didn't have that. And then that's not even getting into the definition of a natural-born citizen. Okay, that's just, this basic question of, is he born here? Never had that. Mm-hmm. Never looked at it. And it's not like the issue didn't exist. We had lawsuits.
Right.
We had petitions. Charlie, you can tell us.
I wrote dozens of letters myself personally to various senators and reps.
Yeah, yeah. So the issue was there. And they just,
And what did I get back? Nothing. I didn't get a single answer back.
Yeah,
not
so did they exercise their constitutional duty to make sure that this individual was qualified? No, absolutely not. The founders would not have put that in there if they didn't recognize that you could have a president-elect who's not qualified. And that's very simple. You know why? Because the First Amendment gives a person the right to run for office, even if you're not a citizen. You could be a non-citizen, and you can run, and you can get on the ballot, and you can run. Okay?
Yeah, that's the soapbox principle. Anybody can get in a soapbox and say, let me for president.
Yeah, and that's your First Amendment right. But because you have the First Amendment right to run, doesn't mean you're gonna be able to sit if you win.
Right.
Two different things, okay?
Yeah, that's the old, you can put Mickey Mouse on the ballot, and people can elect him. But he's not eligible. He can't swear in Mickey Mouse.
Right, exactly. And that's where Congress comes in. I mean, hopefully the Electoral College would have done that. But they weren't interested either. They didn't have any evidence of where Obama was born. Again, we don't want to repeat that. But, again, we've got an image on a computer, which even if it's legitimate, is not sufficient because it doesn't tell you the same information that the original birth certificate had.
We had failure after failure of vetting. We had it's in the lawsuit. Failure of the political parties. Failure of the press. Failure of the election. The debate commission. Failure of the Electoral College. This failure of the Congress. Failure after failure. You look at this and you say, what the heck went wrong in 2008?
Right.
I have my opinions on that, but we don't have time to go into that tonight.
Yeah. So then the question is, why does Congress have to qualify this person? Well, they have to qualify to make sure he's a natural born citizen. Why do we care to know that he's a natural born citizen? Because you're going to trust this person with your life,
right?
With your liberty.
Because he has sole command of the military too.
Yeah. So there's a reason why Congress has to do that. It's to protect the nation. To protect the people. And if Congress
addition to living up to the fundamental law of our nation, the Constitution itself, they can't just ignore the Constitution. But they did.
And if Congress doesn't do that, they're not protecting, Commander Kirchner, who's a citizen of the United States. Because now they've given him an individual who we don't know who he is. Is he, is he even born here? Well, even if he's born here, he's not a natural-born citizen.
And I took an oath for 33 years of service in the military. As a commissioned officer, I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I never thought I'd have to stand up and fight a domestic enemy, but we are today. So help me God, I'm going to keep this fight going as long as I can. And what do they expect from people who take that oath and want to go out and die for that Constitution? And they sit down there in that D.C. cesspool and just ignore it.
Yeah, they're not doing their job. They're not protecting.
Right.
They're not preserving. Okay. What did Battelle say? That the children of the citizens will preserve. Okay.
They are taking away my liberty. I see us drifting into tyranny. We won't have any liberty left if they keep ignoring the Constitution.
And then the second part of that, number three, we have also Obama. Under the Fifth Amendment, because see, once he became the president, then he's a state actor, he's a federal actor, When I say state, I mean, you know, public. And now he's sitting there without proving himself to be a natural born citizen. So he's not giving protection.
And he's sitting there giving out orders to the military, ordering them to go fight foreign wars, and he doesn't have authority to do that. He hasn't proven his authority to do that.
Yeah, and my clients have those rights which we've seen there, and again, Congress violated those rights and so is Obama by not satisfying his qualification by refusing to even show a basic birth certificate.
Right.
So there he's violating my client's liberty, their safety, their tranquility, et cetera, you know, everything that we've mentioned. So that's how number three works. Okay, so go ahead if you have another question.
Better get to number four. We won't even have any time left for questions from the audience.
No, we still do, and I want to thank you very much for pointing this out, both how Congress and Obama have violated these rights. And they really have violated their oath to the Constitution. So, again, this brings up how everyone is involved in this. So I'm very glad this is included. Now, moving to the last point.
We have an ineligible commander-in-chief, by the way.
Yeah,
we are not under civilian control of the military anymore because he's ineligible. We're under the control of the Pentagon. The chain of command is broken.
We have an
ineligible commander-in-chief, Obama.
I beg everybody who is listening to this who knows anybody in the military or any parent, son, sister, friend, daughter, father who is in the military to realize what this means. And when
and
you
on
think
page
about
15,
the rules of engagement
on page
over
15 of Mario's brief here, petition, we talk about the national security part of it, and we take judicial notice of Lieutenant General Thomas McInerney's retired affidavit on the broken chain of command because of an ineligible president, allegedly ineligible president, and that the officers serving in our military have a right to question that under their oath to support and defend the Constitution, and we call judicial notice to the court-martial of Lieutenant Colonel Terrence Lakin, which is a travesty. A complete travesty. Well, we don't have time to go to that, but it's a complete travesty what they're doing to him. He is being made
and
a sacrificial lamb on the altar of the imposter in the Oval Office.
That's correct. And this, again, shows the wisdom of this case because it is directly about national security. That's why we must have
absolutely
a natural
because
born
that's why natural
right
born
there.
Was put in there. It was a national
right.
security concern. And
that's
we have
right.
a president
yes.
who's meddling in Kenya's government. He definitely is showing affiliation and foreign influence because his father was a part of the tribe he helped over there get a new constitution with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, again, more on this.
We'll go back to the question because that's the purpose of the show. But I am totally outraged about what they are doing to Lieutenant
Agreed.
Colonel Lakin. That man is a true patriot. He knows what his oath means. The rest of them people, those politicos down there in the Pentagon, they are a disgrace.
They really are. And again, look at the extent to which the law has been violated to keep this guy in office. And it cannot stand. We cannot allow it to stand. We have to be visible, and we have to make sure that everyone knows about Lieutenant Colonel Terry Lakin. I have to say every day is Lakin Day as far as I'm concerned. So
that judicial notice request is in there, and I'm hoping that Lieutenant Colonel Lakin's new defense team takes that opportunity to get a stay of proceedings in addition to the change of counsel, that they stay that proceedings until the Kirchner case is resolved.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a disgrace what they're doing in the first place. But
well,
they should wait for the Supreme Court to decide this question. They should put that case on hold until this case is decided.
Correct. Thank you. Fourth question, whether Congress violated the Fifth Amendment rights to equal protection and so forth by verifying McCain's natural-born status and not Obama's. This is a tricky thing because tell us about, well, that's a very simple thing. It's Senate Resolution 511. But how did this make it in as one of the last questions?
Gets into equal protection under the law, I believe.
Yeah, this is an easy one to understand. Basically, you know, we know, like you said, 511, Congress said, is McCain a natural-born citizen? You know,
no. People wrote to Congress, and he wrote editorials about it, and Congress says, the people are asking questions. We better check this.
Yeah, there were some articles written, the New York Times and some other articles.
Professor Jonathan Turley and a New York Times article came out the same day. It was a planned thing. I know that.
Yeah, so the question is raised publicly and also on the TV, always became a natural born citizen.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some question about it. And nobody said,
Chrissy Matthew, the throw up my leg Obama lover, brought it up.
Yeah, and nobody said, that's a racist thing. How could you question somebody's citizenship?
This is a constitutional issue. We got to look at this.
Yeah, this is really important here. Nobody said anybody was racist or they were right wing or conspiracy people. Nobody said, oh my God, these people they still believe that the moon landing was done in a Hollywood studio. Nobody said that.
Truther dust all over everybody.
Yeah. These are birthers. You know, these are nut wings or. They got tinfoil hats and all that.
No, not when it's a Democrat going after a Republican. Nope.
You know, that was all perfectly legitimate, and it was. And it was legitimate.
Sure it was.
It was legitimate for Congress to look into it and for people to raise those questions. It was absolutely legitimate, okay? Whether I agree on the legal analysis, okay, which
that's a whole different story. We don't have to go there.
The
point is they investigated McCain at the request of the people, and they didn't do it for Obama.
Right, and then when there was all these lawsuits filed and all these petitions and et cetera, not a word, not a peep on Obama, not a peep. Okay, and then the question is, wait a minute, how come you're protecting again? We're back to protection. Why did Congress care to investigate Obama? Why? Because, whether they realize it or not, they want to protect the nation to make sure that this person is a natural-born citizen because they have to protect the citizens, okay? They did it for McCain. How come they didn't see the same sense of urgency, the same wanting of protecting,
because the political powers in Congress, the political majority in Congress did a hatchet job going after McCain for cronyism, and they were protecting Obama. That is not equal protection, and that is not the way our Constitution works.
Yeah. If we question Obama's citizenship, we're going to be racist.
But they weren't
racist when they questioned McCain's citizenship.
Yeah, and we're wackos, and we're wackos. We're not constitutionalists. We're wackos. We're birthers.
Yeah.
We're every other name under the book.
Right. Well, if we question Obama's citizenship, okay?
The same guy that said that McCain's questions were very constitutional and must be investigated, Chrissy Matthews on MSNBC, is now standing there and sitting there and calling us racist and all kinds of names and wackos and nut jobs and crazies. Can you imagine that? That's not equal protection by the press or the Congress.
Yeah, of course, the press, they don't have a duty to give equal protection, but the Congress does. The Congress does. And the reason why they qualify is to protect and to preserve the nation, okay, and which includes my clients, Commander Kirchner and, my other three clients.
The Norman, Nelson, and Patterson.
Yeah. Let's name them so that we know who they are. We're talking about
Darryl and Norman.
Darryl
and Norman.
Right.
Lowell Patterson and Don Nelson.
Don Nelson
is a police officer. He also took an oath.
Yeah, those are the other clients.
Right.
And, again, they're entitled to the protection. But Congress, they didn't see it as something, whatever.
The Constitution is most important when the unalienable rights of the political minority are being oppressed and ignored. That's when it's most important. That's what it's there for, to protect the people out of favor politically from the oppressive simple majority who temporarily want to do whatever the heck they want to do, independent of the laws of our nation, the fundamental laws being the Constitution. If they can do it to Article 2, they can do it to the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Third Amendment, every single one of them. So where does it stop? You've got to draw the line in the sand.
Exactly.
And I'm proud of Lieutenant Colonel Aiken for standing up for his oath and risking his whole entire military career for something that's more important than his own self.
Yes, I'm just
feeling the import of those words, and also feeling
I'm standing shoulder to shoulder with Lieutenant Colonel Aiken. I am totally. That man is a man of honor. I will unite with a man of honor. I will not reunite with charlatans.
And there's Lieutenant Colonel's question: Are my orders legal? Where is the military going to go to get that information? They cannot.
The chain of command is broken with an illegitimate commander in chief. The chain of command is broken because all orders emanate. All power of all orders flow back to that commander in chief, and we do not have a legal commander in chief at this time. The Pentagon is running the show.
So look at all of this, folks who are listening, and I know you know this, but think of all the diversions and all the mess that has happened. And
Obama's on vacation. He's flitting around on vacations and politicking.
And this is all the fundamental relating right back to his ineligibility. And yes, the third and fourth questions raise the idea of a, quote, conspiracy and so forth. But that's not where this legal brief went. That's not where this petition went, nor any of the materials. It's profoundly and technically, superbly argued and laid out. I don't think that there's any escape. It is
if the
really,
Supreme Justices of this court do not take my case, our case, we no longer have a Constitution left, and they're cowards. And I know Mario can't say that because he's an officer of the court. And I don't want to prejudice my case, but that's the way I would feel if they don't take this case. Because these questions are historic and of extreme importance to the future of our country. I mean, this is not the first time a man's going to usurp the Constitution out of an Article 2 clause if this man is allowed to get away with it. It's going to happen again and again and again.
And,
there's another issue here also. You know, the arrogance of those who support Obama to sit there and to laugh and to joke and to call concerned Americans patriots, to call them every name in the book. Okay, that also has to be you got to stomp that out.
Right.
So you know, there's so much involved in this case. You know. The Americans have lost respect for Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Really. I mean, that's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's why this case is important also.
They've lost respect for the rule of law, too, because the Constitution
absolutely.
Is a basic law.
And
you know, we're all Americans fighting for the same thing, and because of politics, we're going to throw people under the bus.
I like your guy better than my guy, throw out the Constitution. The Constitution is the glue that held this country together for 233 years. All the different people who came here, they were held together by that glue. And they now want to destroy it. By doing that, they will destroy this country. And the golden, the noble vision the founders created will be destroyed. We will no longer be a nation of laws. We'll be a nation of men, and the men will be fighting with each other.
That's right. And I put up a post today on the Usurpathon continuing because this is absolutely it. This is the case.
This is the case.
Supreme Court must hear this, and we must force them to do so. This is our role now. You know, look at all the work that these two fine, outstanding patriots have done here, not only doing the case but finding the right attorney and having Mario do this.
Mario did a brilliant job all the
way
through. But this petition is a masterpiece, Dr. Kate.
I encourage
every American citizen to download this petition and read the 31 pages. It's not hard to read. It's written in plain English, 31 pages, nicely typeset, easy to read. You can read it in 25 minutes. It's a masterpiece on constitutional law and our inalienable rights and the need to protect them and stand up Americans and protect it.
And ladies and gentlemen listening out there, this is one of our founding documents in terms of as we move forward to take this country back. So store it. This is historic, historic piece. Mm-hmm. I want to just...
Mario's writing will live in history. I'm telling you that.
It
this
will.
Petition is going
this
to live in
will.
History.
And we have to make sure this court hears it or resign. Or resign.
I
so,
still believe in them. I think they're going to take this case. But I'm saying if they don't take this case, I'm going to be shaking my head for the rest of my life. And, after that, Dr. Kate, it's up to we the people we've lost the rule of law and our legal system
that's
has failed us.
That's why it's so important, and that's why I'm so glad to have you here explaining this. And then the 5 points that I just wanted to mention is that this is how they have, and maybe you want to do this.
By the way, for the people out there, we asked 2 justices to recuse themselves, too, in this petition.
Yes.
We asked the appointees of Obama to step down and not have anything to do with the case because they have a financial interest in the outcome, their very jobs and lifetime appointments.
Very good. And it looks like even Kagan would have had to anyway since her signature,
mm-hmm.
by way of being Solicitor General, was on there. But that's correct. I'm delighted to hear that.
So
any
Sotomayor and Kagan must step down.
Yeah. So, absolutely. And just wanted to ask you, in that situation, would then the court hear the case with any replacement judges or?
No, under the current laws, 7 would hear it.
Okay, 7 would hear it. Very good. All right, folks.
We need 4. We need 4 to go forward and 5 to win.
That's correct.
We need the votes. We need the votes of 4 to go forward and 5 votes to win.
Very good. Okay.
We don't need
if there's
7 here, we don't. Pardon?
Well, if there's 7, then.
That's another law question. I assume we needed 5 because of 9, but if it's 7, maybe 4 wins, huh?
Right.
That's an interesting thing. I never thought of that. I thought they had to get the majority of 9 votes that would have been there, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, because then you're being forced to do a greater percentage because of refusal.
So are you sure about that, Mario? 4 to go forward and 4 to win in our case.
Well, let's put it that way. I don't want to say it right now, okay? But
came up tonight on the air here.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And, again, we need to make sure that they hear this case. So there's a lot of work for us to do out here to help you out. Let me ask you, if you've submitted this petition, is the government, do they have a right to submit anything? And could their submittal delay any decision, which looks like you're supposed to hear, quote, unquote, on November 3rd or so, if they're going to take it or not?
Yeah, they have 30 days, and it's if you look at the Supreme Court the docket, it says they are response by November 3rd. That's your 30 days,
mm-hmm.
and they can send in for an extension. They can do that,
mm-hmm. like at the 11th hour.
Yeah, they can send in an extension,
mm-hmm.
so then it would be delayed in that respect. Once their opposition brief is in, or if the time to file one is over, because they're not obligated to file one, but the court might order them to do it. You don't know. So they can just say, we're not answering this, or they can send in a brief, not a brief, or the court could order them to do it. But the point is, they can do that. And then I have a chance to send in a reply brief. And what's interesting is that the clerk – will distribute the documents being the petition, and if there's an opposition brief and a reply brief, not less than 10 days after the time is up for the opposition brief, okay? Not less than 10 days. So basically it could be the 10th day after that November 3rd. The clerk can distribute the documents, and then whatever day that is, then you look to see when the conference is. Okay, because
the next regular conference, right?
Right, right, because it matches. In other words, let's say November 13th, for example. Okay, then you look on the list there in the Supreme Court. It'll tell you when the conference is. Okay, and that would be the conference date. Now, I can still submit my reply brief.
Now, when Mario talks about submitting his reply brief, it brings up something for me. I've been leading the fundraising. It cost us almost $4,000 to print up these petitions, by the way the court wants them. If we got to submit reply briefs and responses, it's going to cost us more money. We need to get contributions. People need to go to www.protectourliberty.org. protectourliberty.org, and make a donation. We are fighting for all you citizens out there, fighting for your rights. Get off the couch and at least donate some money to help us. www.protectourliberty.org. We need to raise the money to enable this case to go forward. The plaintiffs and the people who have contributed, we thank them all. But we need more people to help. Thank you.
Yes, this is just so serious. If you are tied down, whatever you can, because this is about our Constitution. This is it. No other petition.
We lose our liberty. What's the job going to mean if they lose their liberty?
That's correct. Now, I just want to. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, the reply brief has to be professionally done. So that's why Commander Kirsten
right.
is asking for it, because you just can't print it out of your computer, so to speak.
You can't send them a Word document. They want it printed on paper. They want it bound on a certain quality, shine, font,
certain margin,
color,
right.
color.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be perfect binding and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. So very critical. To do that support, please, and whatever you can. And head to my website as well. There's a place there. Now,
and I also want to mention, can I quickly mention Attorney Apuzzo's legal blog at puzzo1.blogspot.com. P-U-Z-O, the number one, .blogspot.com. You go there and you will read a almost two-year history now of excellent writing on natural-born citizen and everything else that's at issue here with this Obama usurpation of our Constitution and the office he holds, or de facto putative office he holds.
Mm-hmm.
He's the putative
de facto.
The office is okay.
Remember
he's
everyone
the
out
problem.
There. That's right. Remember everyone out there. I know we have places to donate and so forth, but, we can't put all eggs in one basket, and this case is just as important, if not, equally important as Lieutenant Colonel Lagan's case. This is it, folks. If you can work on these, specifically over the next month or so and continue from there, this is just absolutely critical.
This is a civil case.
Lagan's
is a criminal case. Our case is important. Mm-hmm. Even if it does, they don't even address it at the time to get rid of Obama. For the future, we need to define what a natural-born citizen is in Article 2. We cannot allow this uncertainty and political shenanigans to happen ever again. Never.
That's right. And I just wanted to mention, this segues into the 5 points you made. The nation needs a definition because of what's happening with anchor babies, immigration, so
right.
forth and so on. This impacts the nation's foreign policy.
As Mario pointed out, we have a right to protect the very culture and state of our nation by determining who is a citizen.
That's
correct. They just want to give citizenship away to anybody who walks across the line. It's ridiculous, let alone natural born. The country is out of control. The progressive socialists are out to ruin this country, create a massive crisis, and take over in a dictatorial manner. That has been
correct.
Their history. For 100 years of progressive movements anywhere else in the world, it ends up in tyranny.
And if this is allowed to stand, it's setting precedent. We cannot have that. So the rule of law needs to be protected, and the
That's
balance
right.
of power between the branches of government must be protected. And finally, this is about the national security of the United States. So please, everybody, get with the program here. This is what's going on. So
and go to
now,
Dr. Cates,
like to,
one more blog. Go to Dr. Cates' blog, another excellent writer on the Constitution, Dr. Cates. You are a
you.
True
thank
patriot. You.
You
are a masterful writer, and your words should be published far and wide. You have your URL handy to blurt it out? I can't remember. DrCates.wordpress?
It's DrCatesView.wordpress.com.
Mario,
yeah,
what do you think?
I second what Charlie said.
Yeah, your writings are wonderful. You are a true patriot. And I said I would stand shoulder to shoulder with honorable men. Well, I'm including honorable women, too.
Yes.
And you are one of them. You are a true
thank
patriot.
Thank you, and likewise with you. And, you know, I just have to thank you because I've learned so much from you. And
right.
I would recommend that everybody reads the work of Mario Puzo. It's terrific. Now,
and Charlie Kirshner. He also has articles there.
Absolutely, and Charles Kirshner, absolutely.
No, I'm a contributor there and also help moderate, but Mario's done the lion's share of the